This is the Afternoon Magazine, and I'm Amy Guida, Legal Issues in the News commentator, sitting in for Celeste Quinn. This is the last Friday of the month, and that means it's time for The Law and You. Today, I talk with the author of a compelling book called Contempt of Court, the turn-of-the-century lynching that launched 100 years of federalism. Mark Curran is the legal affairs writer for the Dallas Morning News. He's also an attorney. We'll talk with him about the case, a terribly troubling one, and its impact. We'll take your calls as we go along here. Please call to ask a question or make a comment. The number is 333-9455 from Champaign-Urbana or from anywhere else. Call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL. And 1-800-222-WILL. Good afternoon, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Tell me the story of Ed Johnson. Who was he?
Well, Ed Johnson was a young, 24-year-old young man. He was African-American living in Chattanooga, Tennessee. He had dropped out of school right at the beginning of the third grade. He couldn't read. He couldn't write. He was a day laborer. He was basically a roofer. He was charged with this crime in which the evidence is overwhelming that he did not commit.
And you say the crime. What happened? Take us from the beginning.
Nevada Taylor, back in January 22nd, 1906, was on her way home. Nevada Taylor was 21 years old. She worked as basically a financial clerk, an auditor, if you will, at a downtown Chattanooga, Tennessee grocery store. And she was on her way home around 6 p.m. one evening. The sun had already set behind Lookout Mountain, and it was a very dark evening. And she rode an electric trolley to her home, which was at the foot of Lookout Mountain. She lived with her father. And as she stepped off the electric trolley, she waved goodbye to the trolley conductor and walked between a couple of buildings towards her home, and she heard some footsteps come up behind her. Before she could turn around, a leather strap went around her throat. And she was choked into unconsciousness. The only thing she remembered, according to the police reports from 1906, was that the attacker told her, "Don't scream or I'll kill you," and that he was about her height. As a matter of fact, she couldn't even tell the sheriff that night whether the attacker was white or black.
And later on, of course, she was Caucasian. Later on, she did change that story, right? Meaning that she claimed to be able to identify her attacker as someone who was African-American black.
Yes, she thought later on there was a police lineup where there was only two individuals that took place. And interestingly, she didn't really identify him through the look. It was through his voice. She said she remembered the attacker had, quote, a soft, kind voice, which is kind of a remarkable thing, with the circumstance. But Nevada Taylor actually became a very interesting witness because as the case went on, in some respects, she was Ed Johnson's best witness.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, what happened was in the story is that Ed Johnson is put on trial. And he's put on trial basically 2 weeks after he's arrested.
Yeah, amazing.
Yes, and he's appointed three lawyers. Two lawyers had never handled a criminal case before. The third was actually a very good lawyer, and they had asked the judge, can we delay the case? Because even in the days after the arrest, there was a couple of lynching attempts on Ed Johnson's life at the jail. But Ed Johnson's life was spared only because the governor and the sheriff had taken Ed Johnson out of town, out of Chattanooga, and put him in the jail in Nashville, where there was not many high feelings or no emotional, not so much emotion. And bottom line was they finally brought him back to Chattanooga 2 weeks after the crime, put him on trial. And Nevada Taylor, the victim, was really the first key witness. And she took the witness stand, and she said, "I'm pretty sure that's him. I think it's him. It could be him. I'm pretty sure it's him." At which point a juror actually stood up in the jury box and said, "Ms. Taylor, can you swear that that's him?" And she said, "I cannot swear, but I think it's him. It sounds like him. He was about that height. I'm pretty sure it's him." At which point another juror actually stands up and starts running towards the defendant, only to be held back by other jurors. And as he's held back, he screams out across the courtroom, quote, "If I could get at him right now, I would tear his heart out."
Now, you researching this and finding this out as a lawyer, what should those defense attorneys have done at this point?
Oh, they certainly should have asked for a mistrial. They certainly should have asked the judge to instruct the jury that this just was not proper conduct. Jurors should not be attacking any person in the courtroom, let alone the criminal defendant. Not only did the lawyers not ask for a mistrial, not only did the judge not instruct the jury that, you know, you need to calm down, that was bad conduct, et cetera, the case just kept right on going.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned initially that after Ed Johnson was arrested for this, there was almost an attempted lynching, let's say. They went to the jail to find him.
Right.
And then the victim did what I believe you called an extraordinary thing, which is she asked for no violence. She asked for no mob scenes. What do you think about that? What was her motivation?
Well, it was interesting because her brother, actually, was one of the leaders of the lynch mob. They brought him down there to just kind of rile up these 500, 600, 700 people who were down there, and these were mostly white men from the suburbs of Chattanooga who had come in, who had been outraged. I mean, keep in mind, the newspapers that morning of Nevada Taylor's attack, and the accusation was she was raped, and there's no evidence to the contrary. The only evidence that she was raped was that the doctor who examined her said that the quote was, the brute succeeded in his dastardly deed.
And we didn't ask much questions beyond that back then.
That's right. That's right. And so Nevada Taylor's younger brother, happened to be part of the lynch mob attempt that first night that Ed Johnson was arrested. And all these people go to the jail, and they know Ed Johnson's been arrested, and they're going to go down there, and they're going to take Ed Johnson out of the jail, and they're going to lynch him over the Walnut Street Bridge, which spans over the Tennessee River. And her brother's down there and giving these comments about how wonderful his sister is. Well, the lynching attempt did not go off that night because Ed Johnson wasn't there. And instead, the next morning in the paper, Nevada Taylor gives an exclusive interview to the morning newspaper in which she says she basically denounces her own brother, saying that he should not have done that, you know, that she has talked to him and that he will no longer participate, and that she thought that, the trial should be allowed to go forward. And she basically denounced any kind of violence involving lynchings.
And as you say, then, a trial does take place very, very quickly. What was the evidence against Mr. Johnson?
Well, there's two main witnesses. One was Nevada Taylor, the victim, and she says she thinks it's him, it looks like him, it sounds like him, he's about my height, he was wearing a hat, da-da-da-da-da. That was witness number one, was Nevada Taylor. But again, even she said she would not swear that it was absolutely him. The second witness was an informant who was paid about $350 by the governor and the sheriff. And this was a gentleman who was the person who pointed the sheriff to Ed Johnson. And he testified that he had seen Ed Johnson in the neighborhood of where the crime took place, about the time the crime took place, the night that the crime took place, with a leather strap like the one used in the crime. And that was one of the key witnesses for the state. Now, under cross-examination and through other witnesses, we learned that, A, he was paid $350.
A lot of money back then.
A lot of money. Several weeks, several months paid, several months paid. It was maybe even for him at that point, even more than that. The other thing happened was that they brought up another witness who testified that the morning after the reward was offered, was announced in the newspaper, that this guy, his name was Will Hickson, the informant, came forward and said, saw Ed Johnson working somewhere, and came up to the foreman of the roofing project and said, who is that guy up there? And he goes, well, that's Ed Johnson. And he just kind of nodded and, took down his name and then went on. So the speculation being that was actually the first time he had ever seen Ed Johnson, and he was just looking for a young black man to be able to point the finger to.
And in complete contrast, then, the defense witnesses, a litany of people saying that Ed Johnson was someplace else at the time of the crime.
That's right. Ed Johnson had a second job, working nights, basically tending pool tables at a place called the Last Chance Saloon. And it's called the Last Chance Saloon because it sits right on the border of the Tennessee-Georgia line, and North Georgia at that time was completely dry. No alcohol sold, but in Chattanooga you could. And so it was called the Last Chance Saloon. And about 11 witnesses testified that they were an alibi, that Ed Johnson was with them that night at the time that the attack on Nevada Taylor took place.
Mm-hmm. In the end, the jurors decide that he's guilty.
In the end, they find him guilty. And then an extraordinary thing happens, is the judge announces that he's going to do the sentencing, but he asked the lawyers to go back and meet with Ed Johnson and to talk to him and see if they couldn't get him to confess. So there's this extraordinary meeting that takes place in Ed Johnson's jail cell. He's already been convicted, and his own lawyers go to him and they say, "Now, Ed, got some bad news. You've been convicted, and you are a convicted rapist and so forth, and the judge is undoubtedly going to sentence you to die. You have two options. You can appeal, and you have every right to appeal, but we don't think that there's any real error and that your case will be reversed. And number two is your second option is that, but first they said before that, is that if you appeal, we're almost certain to see a lynch mob come to the jail. And now that you're a convicted rapist, we guarantee you the governor and the sheriff will no longer protect you. And the lynch mob will take you out, and they will kill you, they will lynch you, it'll be a horrible death, and they may come after your family. And they may come after us, your lawyers, and we think that's a bad idea. So we suggest option number two, which is just waive your rights to appeal, accept the death sentence, and die an orderly death.
Die peacefully. Now, again, as a lawyer reading this, researching this, finding this out, how do you react to such a thing?
Well, it was outrageous conduct. I mean, number one, of course, is that there was outrageous conduct during the trial. You can't have jurors attacking defendants in the middle of the trial. But, these lawyers may have known something, that the case did go up on appeal to the Tennessee Supreme Court, and the Tennessee Supreme Court upheld it, saying that they found no error. But just the fact that it's the lawyer's job to always represent the best interest of the client, and not to put their own self-interest first. It was just outrageous conduct.
Do you think there's any chance, though, that they thought they were representing their client's best interest by saying, "Let's die peacefully here, Ed Johnson"?
I don't think so. I think now one of the lawyers, kept quiet because he had objected. He did not want to send this message to Ed Johnson, the one criminal lawyer, a former judge actually named Lewis Shepard. But he just remained quiet because the others had agreed that's what they thought should happen. The bottom line was, if you really read between the lines, is that, I think they were interested in their own, in just protecting themselves and in kind of not having a lynching. And there was this overwhelming attitude in Chattanooga, Tennessee back then that, lynchings were bad. Even though lynchings had taken place by the dozens in just about every other southern city, Birmingham, Nashville, Knoxville, Atlanta, Charleston, Chattanooga had only had two in history up to this point. And the reason was, well, there's numerous reasons. Chattanooga was actually seen as a very progressive city. Many white northerners had moved to Chattanooga because it was an industrial town. As a result of it being an industrial town, there were very few slaves pre-Civil War. Instead, there were lots of African Americans, lots of blacks, but they were all trained laborers, working in mills and textile factories, et cetera. And so, in some respects, Chattanooga was very progressive. It was the only southern city to vote overwhelmingly, and it was like 5-1, to approve, to ratify the 14th Amendment to the Constitution.
Let me break in here to say, if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, the number is 333-9455 from Champaign-Urbana. From anywhere else, 1-800-222-9455. Now, two African-American lawyers got involved with this case. How?
Yes. Two lawyers. One's name was Stiles Hutchins. And Stiles Hutchins in 1906 was this 53-year-old young lawyer. Not young at that point, but he was a 53-year-old lawyer who had been the first black person to graduate from the University of South Carolina School of Law. He did so in 1871. He then became the first black lawyer to ever license to practice law in the state of Georgia later that same year. He moved to Chattanooga, and in 1886, he was actually elected to the state legislature, where he served a couple of terms. He and his partner, another lawyer named Noah Pardon, and Noah Pardon was about 15 years younger than Stiles Hutchins. They were approached by Ed Johnson's father and asked to take up this case. At first, they were kind of reluctant, but they agreed. And these two black lawyers basically take his case up on appeal.
And reluctant, and why?
Well, I mean, they were both building a law practice in Chattanooga, and you know, they saw this as really detrimental to their economic income. You know, take on this case, and wow, everybody will remember it. Keep in mind, all juries back then were white men. Blacks were excluded, women were excluded, you know, being a black lawyer, you still had to appear before those judges and those jurors. And so, you know, to cause waves, to be a flamboyant, progressive, you know, someone who was involved in pursuing civil rights to the courts, would really mean being detrimental to your clients and seeking any kind of, you know, in whether you were suing someone or whether you were a criminal defendant. And if people knew, well, wait a minute, the judges and the jurors don't like this lawyer, they would never get hired.
So these African-American attorneys get involved. They decide to appeal this case. And the trial court judge makes an incredibly racist comment after they announce they'll appeal.
They did. He stood up. They walk into court just 3 days, by the way, after the conviction had the judge had sentenced Ed Johnson to death. And Noah Pardon stood up and said, "Judge, Noah Pardon and Stiles Hutchins for defendant Ed Johnson. We're here to file a motion for new trial on behalf of Ed Johnson." And it took the judge by surprise because he knew that Ed Johnson had planned to waive his rights to appeal. And he said, well, come back tomorrow. Come back tomorrow. And so they come back the next day. And he told him, come back tomorrow because my docket is really full. My calendar is full, and I just can't handle this case today. So they come back the next day, and they stand before the judge, and they say, "Judge, we're here to handle the appeal of Ed Johnson and ask for a new trial." And the judge, a guy named Sam D. McReynolds, says, "Well, now, you know," he said, "you should have come in yesterday because, well, we have local rules, and the local rules say that you have to file a motion for new trial within 3 days. So your motion is denied. And besides," he said, "what do you think you black lawyers," as he said, "you Negro lawyers can add that a white lawyer hadn't already thought about?"
Oof. And yet they did add something, and they worked their way all the way to the United States Supreme Court. How? What happens in Washington?
Well, they file something in the local federal court that had never been filed before, at least not successfully. They filed what's called a federal habeas petition. Now, federal habeas petitions are basically known now. I mean, they're well-known, well-respected. You know, I mean, it happens every day in nearly every criminal trial. But in 1906, none had ever been successful. So what we saw happen was they filed this federal habeas petition. The local federal judge decides to hear evidence in the case. He hears evidence, and at the end of the day, he decides, you know, I don't have jurisdiction. True, Ed Johnson probably got a sham of a trial. And true, he's probably innocent. But you know what? This is a state case, not a federal case. And the federal courts and the U.S. Supreme Court have never intervened or stepped into and gotten involved in a state criminal matter. So he basically said, petition denied. But he did allow the lawyers to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so Noah Pardon gets on a train, he travels to Washington, D.C., and he files his motion for appeal right with the U.S. Supreme Court.
And what were the grounds for appeal? What had gone on at trial he believed was unconstitutional, if I can say that?
Two basic grounds. One was the 14th Amendment issue. And the 14th Amendment issue involving due process, that Ed Johnson did not receive due process in his trial. Now, he also argued a Sixth Amendment claim, right to fair trial in a criminal case. Now, the problem is that the U.S. Supreme Court at this point had never said that the Sixth Amendment applies to state criminal court cases, the incorporation doctrine. It had not applied. So he was basically arguing something that had never been argued before. His basic grounds were this. Number one is that Ed Johnson's trial should not have gone on the way that it went on. It should have been delayed, that there was a lynch mob outside waiting to take him. There was incredible pressure on the lawyers and the judges and the jurors to find Ed Johnson guilty and sentence him to die. The case should have been moved out of Chattanooga. It should have been tried months later, not 2 weeks after the crime. Number two was that the juries themselves that Ed Johnson did not get a fair trial because the jury was all white men. And number three was the whole Sixth Amendment issue about Ed Johnson being attacked in the courtroom by a juror. And they just said, oh, that's inherently unfair and a lack of due process and a violation of the Sixth Amendment. Those were really kind of the three major grounds.
And when we say that they argued that, they actually met with Justice Harlan over this.
That's right. Noah Pardon goes up and he presents the petition to the court, and he has this long day at the Supreme Court. And this was back when the U.S. Supreme Court actually met in the chambers, in the old Senate chambers at the U.S. Capitol.
On a Saturday, no less.
On a Saturday. And there was this big conference room off of the Supreme Court room. It was the Supreme Court only had three rooms back then. They had the big courtroom. They had what they called the cloak room or the robing room, which was really kind of a big waiting room. And that's where Noah Pardon sat. And then they had a big conference room. And he didn't see how many justices were in there until his name was called, and he walks in the front door into the conference room. And there, Noah Pardon again, this 39-year-old young black attorney, no black attorney had ever argued a case before the Supreme Court of the United States. He walks in, and at the end of this table is this huge mountain of a man. John Marshall Harlan of Kentucky was about 6'5". He weighed about 275 pounds. He had this big flaming red hair on the side and completely bald on top. And he was kind of a bombastic fella. Never small talk, cut to the chase. Truly an incredible, now we look at him as a great legal icon, but he was greatly feared back then.
Mm-hmm. So they present their case.
He gets about 5 minutes to just say, this is my argument. And he does so, and he says everything that I just said about what the legal arguments were, the whole violation of the 14th Amendment, due process, the lack of a fair trial, and he walks all the way through it. And then his time is up, and he leaves, and he really leaves without any feeling that he had convinced Justice Harlan at all. As a matter of fact, he left. He wrote an article on his way back to, wrote a letter on the train ride back home saying that he believed that he had lost, that the U.S. Supreme Court had never intervened in a state criminal matter, and they wouldn't on this one.
And as an attorney, you read what he said. How would you rate his performance on appeal?
Noah Pardon's?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Noah Pardon, we had the great privilege, luck, if you will, of finding Noah Pardon's writings. He wrote for a couple of black newspapers at the turn of the century. One of them was called the Atlanta Independent, and the other the Chattanooga Blade. And he was a wonderful orator. If his writings are anywhere close if his courtroom abilities, which we hear they were, if they were anywhere close to his ability to write, he was just he must have been dazzling. And he had a great grasp of the law. He was a great storyteller, because his articles were wonderful storytelling. And so, on the other hand, you're before a Supreme Court justice for the first time. You could even tell. He even admits in one of his letters just how nervous he was and how stressful. He had the burden of trying to save his client back home, who he absolutely believed was innocent. Yet here he was at this historical moment, not just historical for himself,
mm-hmm.
but historical for the country, in that this is the first time a black lawyer had ever appeared before the court, and the first time that the court had heard a state criminal death penalty case directly on appeal.
And he gets back home, the attorney gets back home, and then hears what from the court?
He walks off the train, and he immediately hears people greet him and tell him congratulations that, lo and behold, his message had gotten through, and that Justice Harlan had convinced five other members of the court to sign a stay of execution and to hear the case on an emergency appeal.
So to actually, for them to actually go to the court and argue in front of all the justices,
yes.
that this indeed was unconstitutional, what happened in Chattanooga.
Yes.
So back in Chattanooga, word reaches that angry mob.
The next morning, the newspaper headline in the Chattanooga Daily Times was that the gallows in the basement of the Hamilton County Jail have once again been disappointed. They wrote this article that the U.S. Supreme Court has interfered in the Chattanooga people's business of Chattanooga, that how dare Washington do this, that it's an infringement on state rights. And the article very clearly said no doubt a lynch mob will appear tonight at the Chattanooga jail and to end Ed Johnson's life.
Again, incredible reading that as a lawyer, but more importantly as a reporter. What do you think about reporting like that, inciting violence?
Totally inflammatory. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, obviously it was. I mean, you know, we don't even have to say that it was inflammatory. The interesting thing is that it's unclear just how far or how much the writers back then were leading the community down this path versus how they were reflecting the community's attitudes. Because keep in mind, I mean, this newspaper, the Chattanooga Daily Times, was owned, the first newspaper, owned by Adolf Ochs. And Adolf Ochs used his profits from the Chattanooga Times to then buy a little newspaper we know today as the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And he was truly one of the first pioneers in independent journalism where we didn't take a real strong stance one way or the other, where we just reported the facts.
So the mob hears the word that Ed Johnson could conceivably go free. You describe so well the anger in your book and also Ed Johnson's fear as he's sitting in the jail hearing the mob getting closer.
Mm-hmm. It was amazing. One of the things that happened was, not only did the sheriff not protect Ed Johnson, as the, by the way, the order directly, implicitly, from Justice Harlan said for him to do, the order directly stated that there had been prior lynching attempts and that Ed Johnson is now a federal prisoner under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Supreme Court, and that the law enforcement and sheriff of Hamilton County is to protect him, just as they had. Not only did they not protect him, not only did they not move him out of Chattanooga, the sheriff literally gave almost all of his deputies, all but one, an elderly deputy, the night off.
Mm.
And he moved all the inmates, except two, Ed Johnson and a woman named Ellen Baker. And he moved all the other inmates to another part of the jail, away from where the lynch mobbers would come. And so when the lynch mobbers actually come to the jail, there's actually an eyewitness. And the reason that he left Ellen Baker there is, the best we can figure, she was white, she was a woman. She was arrested, she was on her honeymoon, and she was arrested for moonshining. And they just call her throughout the case the moonshining woman. And she talked all the time. She just constantly talked. And they actually threatened at one point, the lynch mobbers do, to they were going to lynch her first if she just didn't shut up.
Hmm. Not trying to save Ed Johnson's life.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, afterwards, her ability to talk also gave us incredible detail, because later there was a federal investigation of this, and she gave over 200 pages of sworn deposition about what happened that night. And she watched Ed Johnson, and she was in the cell right next to him and saw everything and heard his words. And she later gave sworn testimony about every minute detail that happened during the lynching, during the break-in of the jail.
And so what happens? The mob goes in, grabs Ed Johnson after many minutes.
That's right.
As he hears them getting closer and closer. Then what happens?
They take him out of his jail cell. And like you said, I mean, at first they struggled to get into the jail cell because, you know, I mean, lynch mobbers weren't exactly the most intellectual group in town. They were told that this deputy would be there and he'd have a key, but they were impatient because they couldn't find the deputy to begin with, so they started beating at the jail cell door. It was this big iron lock to get into Ed Johnson's cell. And so they started beating on it with sledgehammers and axes and picks. And when they finally, 15 minutes later, found the jailer and he gave them the key, they had been beating on the lock so much that it had destroyed or distorted the lock and they couldn't fit the key inside anymore. So it literally took them 3 hours to get Ed Johnson out.
Oof.
And they take him out of the jail, and they walk him down to the Walnut Street Bridge, which goes over the Tennessee River in downtown Chattanooga. And they say to him, Ed, you're going to die. There's nothing you can say that will save your life. And the noose is already around his neck. And they say, Ed, just confess. Just confess. And instead, Ed Johnson's last words were, God bless you all. I am an innocent man. And that just sent the crowd, the lynch mob, into a fury, and there were several hundred of them, and they lifted him up, and his body swung out over the Tennessee River. And apparently he wasn't dying fast enough, because then they started shooting, and he was shot more than 50 times. And one of the bullets actually pierced the rope, and his body kind of clunked to the ground, and another leader of the lynch mob unloaded his weapon, reloaded it, and shot him 5 more times.
Mm. Ed Johnson dies and then the lynch mobbers leave a note on his body.
They did. Actually, it was a police officer walks up and pins a note right into Ed Johnson's chest. And it said, quote, "To Justice Harlan and the Supreme Court, here's your Negro now. Try to save him."
What was the significance of that note? What was the reaction at the United States Supreme Court to this?
That was the note that was put in the newspapers immediately, and that's the note that got played back to the got told to the Supreme Court, and they immediately were outraged, and they hold an emergency session at the Chief Justice's home in the Foggy Bottom area of Washington, D.C., and seven members of the court, I believe, attended this meeting, and they knew right away they had to take action, that the whole authority of the U.S. Supreme Court was being impugned, and so they literally get the president, Theodore Roosevelt, on the telephone, and as they put it, then he turned and got the attorney general there. And they instructed the Attorney General to send federal agents to Chattanooga to investigate, to see what, if any, crimes had been committed and what needed to be done.
And how unusual was that?
Oh, extraordinary. I mean, the only other time that we can find is a railroad investigation, more of a civil racketeering kind of deal, where the unions, there was a question about whether the unions were conspiring. That was the only other example I could find where the Attorney General, and certainly no place in history, not before, not since, have we ever seen the U.S. Supreme Court ever asking or instructing, is the way they put it, instructing federal law enforcement to conduct an investigation.
And what did federal law enforcement find?
Two agents went to Chattanooga for 3 weeks, and they investigated and they interviewed witnesses, and what they found, they concluded, was that there was a conspiracy between the sheriff and the deputies and members of the lynch mob to basically kill Ed Johnson in violation of the Supreme Court's stay order.
Yeah, and the sheriff blames it all on the Supreme Court, nosing into state, local criminal business where it doesn't belong.
Right. He gives this extraordinary interview to the Birmingham News when he happened to be visiting Birmingham, and he gave them, and he said, "The Supreme Court is to blame for this lynching. Everything else was fine, and the Supreme Court stuck its nose where it shouldn't have. It interfered in the state business of the people of Chattanooga." And, he totally blamed the Supreme Court, and that just even more outraged the justices on the court. And that statement, combined with the fact that the investigator's report led the Supreme Court to basically instruct the Attorney General to bring criminal contempt charges against the sheriff and the deputies and members of the lynch mob.
And why don't you explain what that means exactly, why this is so extraordinary?
Well, number one, this had never happened before, has never happened since, where the Supreme Court actually took steps to enforce one of its orders in a punitive fashion. The Supreme Court normally relies on two things in its order. It has no police officers. It has no army to go out. It relies on, A, our respect for the rule of law, that when the Supreme Court says, "President Nixon, you got to turn over the tapes," that President Nixon turns over the tapes. And number two, that their arguments, that their rulings basically are so clear and decisive and convincing that they are that's their only other method by which we obey their decisions, is that they convince us that this is the right decision, even if we don't like it, whether it's abortion or the death penalty or whatever it may be, that we may not like it, it's not what we would do, but our respect for the rule of law and their basic argument or their position is such that it carries weight with us. So that's how extraordinary this was, is they had no other decision they had ever made needed enforcement. This was the first and only time.
And so what happened? They bring witnesses to Washington, D.C.?
What they did actually was they appointed a special master, the deputy clerk of the court. And the deputy clerk of the court went to Chattanooga for a period of over a year and a half and took the sworn statements of scores of witnesses, like 6,000 pages of sworn testimony from witnesses who had been there, who had heard what the sheriff had said, everybody from the sheriff's cook to ministers in town who had tried to stop the lynching, to the black lawyers, to members of the jail, and of course Ellen Baker, who was right next to the cell with Ed Johnson, and she gave a couple hundred pages of sworn testimony about what had happened. And that became, when each witness's testimony was taken, the clerk would then send it to the justices, who would read it. And then each side, the sheriff's side and the federal government, got a week to argue their case, which is extraordinary because today we only get, of course, 30 minutes to argue our case. But back then, they gave them a whole week, each side a week to argue their case.
Mm-hmm. In the title of your book, it said that this case launched 100 years of federalism. What do you mean by that?
Well, there was one of the great arguments made by the sheriff and his lawyers was the Supreme Court can't find sheriffship in contempt of the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court did not have jurisdiction to interfere or intercede into the Ed Johnson state criminal matter. It didn't have the jurisdiction. And if you didn't have jurisdiction to stay that execution and to reverse his conviction because it's a state matter, then you couldn't stay his execution. And if you couldn't stay his execution, my clients, the sheriff, cannot then be found in contempt of disobeying those orders. And in an 8-0 decision written on December 24th, Christmas Eve, 1906, Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote that, no, we're the Supreme Court of the United States. And if we say we have jurisdiction, we have jurisdiction. And, you know, I mean, we're not taught this case in law school.
Mm-hmm.
But Thurgood Marshall actually used to, according to Randall Kennedy, who's a law professor at Harvard, used to say that he told me and did a review in The American Lawyer of the book, and he said that when he first started clerking, when we first went to clerk for Justice Marshall, that Justice Marshall actually made all of his new clerks read this opinion.
Mm. And so it's so incredibly important. And yet, what's your theory? Why did it fade into the background?
You know, I'm not sure. You know, it's in and of itself, maybe because they never actually got around to deciding writing an opinion, and making a decision in the Ed Johnson case,
mm-hmm.
that would have been the case that would have truly been cited, had they indeed, you know, proceeded to reverse Ed Johnson's conviction. Mike Tiger, who's a great, prominent criminal defense lawyer and a law professor at American University, Washington School of Law, we were on a TV show together a few months ago, and the Greta Van Susteren from CNN asked him, said, well, Mike, you know, you've been teaching federal courts and federal constitutional law for 30 years, and why had you never heard of this case? And he just totally was just totally baffled and said, you know, he had no clue that he actually, when he read the book, he thought, this can't be true. I've never heard of this case. And he said he went back to the Supreme Court reporters, and he said there it was.
Read it all, yeah.
And he said something that was music to my ears. He said, and now I make it required reading in my class.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I love this man.
Yeah. How did you get involved in Ed Johnson's case?
It was actually a two-prong approach for me. My co-author had actually come across this case, and his name is Leroy Phillips, and he was he taught one of my law school courses at Vanderbilt in Nashville. And he knew about the lynching part of the case because he was from Chattanooga.
Hmm.
I came across the case my third year when I was doing research into contempt powers of Article III judges, of federal judges. And I kept seeing this case called U.S. v. Ship. And when I did my NexusLexis search, and I just picked up the book and read the case, and I was just stunned. I mean, it was just this amazing story, and that's what it is. I mean, it's got all this great, you know, I mean, there's great law there, and there's great morals and so forth, but, you know, beyond all that, it's just an amazing story.
And we have a caller for you on line one. Are you there?
Yes. I wasn't thinking of this when I called. I just was thinking that maybe the background of lynching in America should be pointed at least a little bit, and maybe it's just the incredibly unseemly history that people don't want to look at. In Illinois, which maybe this is to say how far south Illinois is or how ubiquitous even in maybe some northern border states, in the aughts, I think it was '07, there was a lynching of a black shopkeeper that was pretty notorious. I think it led to about two or three other killings by a white mob, and then in the teens, I think it's like 1913 or 14, there was a massive widespread lynching in East St. Louis that is a real stain on Illinois, it seems. And I just think people don't want to look at that kind of crime and how ubiquitous it was, and I'm going to have to hang up and listen to your answer on the air. Thanks.
Sure. And you do get into that a little bit into your in your book, don't you? Do you not?
I do, absolutely. I mean, there's two things. One is there were 32 lynchings in Illinois between 1882 and 1944. 32. There were 4,708 nationwide. These were reported lynchings, and we know this because Tuskegee University in Alabama, which is a great historic school, college, university, collected data. And every time they would find out about a lynching, they would create a file on it. And one of the things we're doing with the proceeds from our book is we're created a trust fund to be able to help preserve all these files they have down there on every reported lynching is still in paper form. And we're trying to be able to protect and preserve those files. But the justices, it was really interesting. When you read their personal notes back and forth, especially between Harlan and Holmes and Chief Justice Fuller, they were really concerned that the rule of law was slipping away. Because between 1890 and 1906, there were 2,100 lynchings that took place in the United States. That was by far the most rampant time for lynchings in this country. 1890 to 1906, 2,100. And yet not in any single one of those 2,100 lynchings was any individual ever arrested, charged, or prosecuted for participating in those lynchings.
Amazing. And your book includes pictures of smiling people at similar lynchings.
Yes.
That must have been just sent chills up your spine when you realized this is what happened to Ed Johnson.
One of the most dramatic times was I spent about a month down at Tuskegee, and they have these files, and there's these story after story and picture after picture, photo after photo of what happened in these lynchings. From United States senators leading lynch mobs from Mississippi and Louisiana as part of re-election bids to cases like this one. The caller was absolutely right. It is the story of what happened to those 4,708 people during that time period is one that it's certainly not one of the better points in our country's history.
Yeah, one small story of many. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have this afternoon. Thanks to Mark Curran, the legal affairs writer for the Dallas Morning News, author of Contempt of Court, the Turn of the Century Lynching that Launched 100 Years of Federalism. Thanks for being here, Mark.
Thank you very much.